In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. Good evening, John Suntress here, and today Alan Heinberg is back to talk about Avengers, the Children's Crusade. The 9-part bi-monthly series begins this week and reunites the Young Avengers creative team of Heinberg and artist Jim Chung. The story is a self-contained event that crosses the Avengers and X-Men worlds as Young Avenger Wiccan searches for the woman he believes is his mother, Wanda, the Scarlet Witch. The longtime Avengers' mind seemed to shatter as she killed Avenger teammates and mutants in the mid-2000s events Avengers Disassembled and House of M. Alan talks about writing a story that will stand the test of time while trying not to conflict with the current month-to-month continuity. We also discuss his 4 years of work on the popular TV series Grey's Anatomy, coming to a close, and the similarities of television writing rooms compared to the Marvel Creative Summits. We wrap things up talking with webcomic creator Patrick Scullin, who discusses his two connected features, Super Siblings, and his family strip, Meet the Clarks. In fact, Super Siblings and Meet the Clarks are our joint sponsors of this episode of Word Balloon. Super Siblings is the all-ages comic series for geeks and their kids created by Patrick Scullin that follows the adventures of a brother and sister with superpowers. Conrad, a.k.a. Scout, uses his for good, while his younger sister Courtney, a.k.a. Banshee, uses hers for bad. What's more, neither knows the other's secret identity. Read Super Siblings, the webcomic, every week at supersiblingscomics.com. All geeks are sure to enjoy this slice-of-life satire featuring James and Donna Clark, the totally ordinary and unsuspecting parents of the Super Siblings. Also, don't miss the ongoing adventures of Scout and Banshee in the Super Siblings comic book. In the latest issue, Super Science, the duo faces off at the Bay City Elementary Science Fair. Print and digital versions of the comic are sold at supersiblingscomic.com, or you can pick up a signed copy at this year's San Diego Comic-Con, where Patrick has a table in the small press pavilion. We'll give you the table number during the interview and at the end of the program. You're sure to enjoy Super Siblings. Don't take my word for it. Tiny Titans and Billy Batts and the Power of Shazam creators Art and Franco say, oh yeah, Super Siblings. And it really is a great companion to those series and other great all-ages series as well. Find it online at supersiblingscomics.com. And check out all the Super Siblings action happening at Patrick's table at the San Diego Comic-Con in the Small Press Pavilion. I was thrilled when I was at, I want to say C2E2, when they made the announcement about the story.
Thanks, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we knew something was brewing, but it was nice to hear some details. And, you know, reading up and everything, I read about the teleconference, and that sounds cool.
Yeah.
And, you know something, it's funny, I didn't even think to look at iFanboy. And had I known, I would have spoken to Ron Richards more because I guess he sat in on it.
Yeah, he so. Was. I think there were four reporters altogether. I had never
That's
done
cool.
anything like that before.
Huh?
Yeah.
Really? Not even for Grays or anything like that?
Not that. That was sort of new, like a phone press conference by phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny coming from sports, like college and pro coaches do it all the time. All the
oh.
time. Yeah. Yeah. So
wow.
very cool, man.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll officially start on the record right now. And obviously we'll get into some Gray stuff, and I got notes from my sister. So, come on, man. She's like the one woman focus group.
Bless your sister, man. That's awesome.
I am so happy that you're back. And I'm sorry it's been so long, but I always figure given your time on Gray's and hearing all of the screenwriters that I know, like you and Loeb and Jesse Alexander, and just those these hellacious days, I'm like, yeah, you know, maybe we'll talk in the summer. But also, you haven't had a new story to talk about, so this is an awesome opportunity to catch up both on Grays and on what's coming up with the Young Avengers.
Oh, thanks. I'm so grateful that you're having me back, and so grateful that I have something to talk about.
I hope you know, and I don't know how much you've seen at the websites or whatever. But so many fans are really excited that you and Jim are coming back to the Young Avengers. And it sounds like this is a much bigger story than just the third arc of what would have been maybe the ongoing series had you guys been able to continue to do it.
Yeah, it's definitely taken on slightly massive proportions at this point.
9-issue bi-monthly series? Is this the plan?
Yeah, it started out as an 8-issue miniseries, and then we added a 9th issue shortly before we announced the book, just because of the way... things are sort of being paced out story-wise. So 9 bi-monthly issues.
Well, I'm going to let you give the broad strokes of what the story is about. I mean, there are some obvious things that have been left dangling, both with the Young Avengers and specifically with Wanda. But tell us, you know, what you can about the story, and we'll ask questions based on that.
Well, technically, it starts, I guess, after the events of Siege, the Young Avengers adventures in the sort of Siege story. It picks up, you know, with full on action. The Young Avengers are on a mission, and something terrible happens. Something goes terribly, terribly wrong, and Wiccan proves to be a kind of Wanda-sized threat to the Marvel Universe. And the Avengers have to sort of wrestle with the question of, if we've got, you know, a kid who's this powerful and can do, you know, Wanda-sized things in the Marvel Universe, what do we do with him? And that asking that question and sort of forcing the other Avengers and the Young Avengers to come to terms with an answer for that question, it's not, it sort of leads to a larger discussion about Wanda and what happened to Wanda. And Wiccan has always felt a real kinship with Wanda and has always suspected that he and Tommy are, in fact, the sons of the Scarlet Witch and the Vision. And that sort of leads him to re-embark on this quest that they actually started, I guess he and Speed went looking for Wanda in the Young Avengers Presents miniseries without any success. But the threat that the Avengers now pose to Wiccan, and again, you know, the Avengers thinking that the Young Avengers as a group probably aren't a very good idea. They're still really young. They're still not very seasoned, not very experienced, and there's no time to train them. It sort of forces the kids to take matters into their own hands and go looking for the Scarlet Witch, and they find her. So that's basically the premise of the book, and then it, you know, it becomes a much larger Marvel Universe story and question, because once you find the Scarlet Witch, what do you do with her? She's the most powerful force, arguably the most powerful force in the Marvel Universe, and there are all kinds of moral and ethical implications, you know, about her returning to the Marvel Universe. I mean, we don't know where she's been, we don't know what she's doing, we don't know if she's a good guy or a bad guy, we don't know what she's capable of. You know, when last we saw her as readers, she seemed to be having some kind of amnesia, whether she was faking it or not. Did she remember everything that happened? Did she not? Did she have powers? Did she not? All of these questions we are going to explore and answer, and it's going to be a really fun, it has so far for me been a really fun journey. It's almost like a fairy tale. It's got kind of big, sweeping, fairy tale-like, you know, movement to it and elements to it that are fun and playful, and at the same time it turns really dark and really savage at times, and ultimately the questions that are being asked are really difficult ones. I've talked a little bit about it in the press about the theme of the story. It's told from Wiccan's point of view, and it's essentially, you know, there's a very fine line between being a good guy and being a bad guy, and Wanda has always sat sort of right on top of it. Mm-hmm. You know, she's Magneto's daughter, and Quicksilver too. Like, they're part of the Brotherhood, but they're also Avengers.
Yes.
And they're incredibly, incredibly complicated characters, and she did these terrible, terrible, unforgivable things, killing her friends and you know, depowering pretty much every mutant in the Marvel Universe except for 200 or so. So what do you do with someone like that? So basically we're gonna try to answer that question. Does that help get us started discussion wise?
That's great, man.
It's epic. There's so many characters in this book, and the trick has been to, you know, to not make Jim draw them all in every panel, and also to keep the story essentially an emotional one and an intimate one.
Indeed.
But you've got, you know, Avengers and new Avengers and, you know, mighty Avengers and former Avengers and X-People.
X-Men,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, so it's been quite a feat. It continues to be quite a feat for Jim. And for myself, to keep all the balls sort of in the air and to keep it focused and fun and keep it so that the readers are feeling things along the way. So I hope people like it.
You've had, you know, only a handful of stories. So to really go into this from a writing standpoint and understanding that, you know, it's a special order for Jim to convey what you want to, as you say, as far as capturing all the characters, but also giving him, you know, room to breathe and room to be able to accomplish this, given his own ability to churn books up, because everyone is always patient and always looks forward to what Jim can do, because he's such a beautiful storyteller, but it does take time. And, yeah, so, I mean, that's got to be kind of a weird balancing thing for you as well in terms of writing the script.
It has definitely been one of my chief considerations in writing the script, is to keep the panel count down and to, you know, to make it manageable for him, especially given the cast size. It's just been, yeah, I mean, he's great at it. He can draw. He can, you know, I don't know if you saw the Bendis, the Free Comic Book Day thing he did
last year.
Brian Bendis, but he can put every character in every panel, and it still looks great, but it takes a long time. So, yeah, we're trying to, you know, we're trying to let Jim breathe and keep the book beautiful and epic at the same time. So, I'm very curious to see what the response is. Although, you know what, I promised myself I wouldn't actually go online and look at what the response is, so I'm just going to hope that the response is good.
Well,
and
I was,
will allow us to keep making more of these comic books at Marvel.
Well, I'll tell you, I was at the Retailer Summit at Chicago's C2E2 convention, and when the announcement came that the Children's Crusade was happening, there were immediate applause amongst the retailers that the two of you were back. Oh, come on, man. Honestly, I said this to, it's funny, I've been going through some old Bendis interviews, the old Bendis tapes, and I was in the 2006 year, and you happened to come up. You've only written a few books. Your batting average is up there, man, and I think people were really excited to hear that the two of you were coming back to these characters. I mean, Cornell has done a wonderful job. The other writers who have touched the Young Avengers have all only built on what you guys started getting that first assignment. But again, those 12 issues are still very special to a lot of people, and so it's no different than Joss Whedon coming back to the Runaways. It is that kind of relationship, I think.
Thanks. That's amazing to hear.
Wanda's being pulled in all these different directions, and people all want her for very different reasons.
Yeah.
And I mean, as you say, there's crimes to pay from both the X-Men and the Avengers, and, you know, just the simplicity of Wiccan wanting to get closer to who he thinks might be his mother. So this is very exciting, and, you know, I mean, totally up your alley. I mean, you handle a lot of the same kind of dynamics when you write for Grays. And granted, you're in a writer's room with a lot of other very talented people, and you have a talented cast. But that's how similar and how different is it, the two experiences?
Well, it's pretty. I mean, there are certain aspects of it that are definitely similar in terms of story breaking. And I do, you know, I really do lean on Tom Brevoort and Jim Chung at almost every level of story breaking. It's just less. It's more fun for me. They have great ideas. So in a way, I guess we are a little writer's room, the three of us. And, you know, I'm not shy about pitching stuff to Jeff Loeb and Jeff Johns at the same time. So I do have help, when I'm breaking the story. So I think it would be quite difficult for me to go from having a team of like 12 people to being all by myself on this thing. So, you know, people, I definitely have my guys who've really helped cook the story and make it better. But it's the actual practice of it, I guess it isn't that different. I had sort of approached comics a little bit differently because of, oddly, even though I'm sort of a dialogue-driven writer, I started writing in the Marvel style toward the end of the run of Young Avengers, just for time, you know, for time's sake, to be able to give Jim, you know, what the sort of panel descriptions are and the content of every panel without dialoguing, because in a weird way, I ended up writing the script, each script, like four or five different times. So I kind of got backed into Marvel style, which is very different from TV, you know, where you would just write a scene and then essentially direct it. That's how I started writing comics. Joe Quesada sort of taught me that, and I think that's how Brian Bendis does it too, where you write the scene and then you sort of empanel it, and then, you know, I don't know how it, I guess it was just the time thing. I got into sort of outlining it and then empaneling it in theory and then going back and dialoguing it fully once I'd gotten the art, which is, I didn't even notice that my process had changed that radically. So I'm only just sort of now going back to the TV way of doing it, where you're actually writing the scenes first.
Do you feel now with these new scripts? I mean, you know, I remember seeing in that first issue of Young Avengers, you guys had that special issue that did include you know, maybe how you initially were going to approach a scene and then how it looked after Joe kind of worked with you and everything, and we saw the revisions in that. So, you know, coming back to that style, is it, do they look similar? I mean, is it back to...
I think the flow is better. I definitely think that just in terms of the dialogue, the flow is better. And, you know, there's a real, especially with Brian Bendis's comics, you get a sense that these are real, living, breathing people, you know, in a room just talking. Like, I love the rhythm of his scripts, and, mm-hmm. and Brian Vaughn has the same kind of dialogue in his books, and that's, you know, that's really my first love. So it's really fun to be getting back to that, especially with a team book where it's so much about camaraderie and less about, you know, an internal monologue kind of a thing. I think going back to that is making this project more fun for me. So yeah, I didn't even realize I had slipped into Marvel style. So it's nice to be able to do it both ways. I just think it's, you know, for me, it's been fun to go back to the dialogue, you know, writing the scene outright first.
How much do you think the characters have changed, and how do you approach them? Because since you've left, things have happened, and relationships have grown and been created, really, since your guys' time as well. So, you know, coming back to these this group, and also especially given how the Marvel Universe changed, it's very funny. Reading the before you answer, I have to acknowledge that reading all the various articles, it's so funny that you really have to almost broadcast the fact that, hey guys, just so you know, this started a few months before things really shook out. Iron Man's still in the old armor. Steve's wearing the Captain America uniform. Just, you know, roll with it. Okay, trust us. But you know, go ahead.
There was no way we could have known, because Jim and I started this 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and when it hit us, it was so, we were both so devastated. Because, you know, originally Steve was supposed to be Cap again, and we didn't know anything about this new Iron Man armor. And so when the reality sort of landed on us, it was like, what do we do? We've got several issues that are drawn, and, you know, and God bless Tom Brevoort for saying, you guys, people will understand. We'll tell people what had happened. And look, it'll be a year and a half before the book finishes coming out. So by the time it does, you'll probably be right in step with the Marvel Universe.
There you
have no idea. So, but I hear that there are, you know, and I'm sure I understand it, there are fans who are upset about it, for whom it is going to, you know, distract from the storytelling. And that, you know, that kills me. I don't want to distract from the storytelling.
I understand that.
Yeah, but I, you know, there was just no way around it. We were going to bump up against something, and better to sort of come clean. And in a way, it takes place in almost exactly the same Young Avengers universe that the initial Young Avengers book took place in. Do you know what I mean?
Certainly.
There have been a lot of changes, but everybody, you know, it's the sort of classic, iconic, you know, this is where we left these kids, and this is where we're picking them up.
It'll look nice in the omnibus when it finally comes out, you know? Let's be honest.
Oh, I hope that there's an omnibus someday.
Me too.
But yeah, it's definitely been interesting because, you know, I mean, this is another thing too. When I have ventured online, which is always a mistake, you know, there are people who are very angry that the characters have been sort of withheld. You know, that there hasn't been an ongoing Young Avengers book.
Sure.
And that you know, I have somehow bamboozled Marvel into keeping the characters in stasis mode while I've been away. And it really isn't true. I mean, I always wanted to tell this story, and Marvel's been great about allowing us to tell it. And so I haven't wanted characters to be... the thing about me and these characters, and this is true about Wonder Woman, it's true about any of the DC characters I've worked on, I just don't believe in, I believe in putting them back the way you found them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, these characters have been around long before any of us, and they're going to outlive all of us, too. So I think there are a lot of folks who feel like in order to make a mark on a book, you really have to mess with the character. You really have to leave an indelible mark on the character. And for me, you know, that's just, it's really superficial and short-sighted. It doesn't, you know, because the next writer is going to come along and change everything too. So I just ask that if people wanted to use the characters, use them however you want and grow them internally and explore issues and, you know, tell great Young Avengers stories, just put them back the way you found them. Do you know? And,
sure.
And in fact, like, that, I'm sort of sticking to the same thing myself. Like, I don't want to, even with this book, there's so many Young Avengers stories that I want to continue telling and that I'd love for other people to tell too. I don't want to, not that there aren't going to be big changes, because there are definitely going to be big changes, but
okay.
I do believe in putting things back the way you found them. But that doesn't mean that a great story or an important story or an essential story can't be told. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
It's a philosophical thing.
Well, I want to understand that, because you're right. And because also there is need for a character to grow somewhat for there to be, I don't know. I mean, because I understand what you're saying about keeping the basics down. There's nothing more ridiculous looking back now than seeing Superman blue during those great Grant Morrison Justice League stories, because it just looks ridiculous. But it made sense at the moment.
Right.
So I can appreciate that from a superficial standpoint. But, yeah, why don't you further explain, as opposed to character growth versus a radical change like... And unfortunately, I can think of superficial things like maybe the Iron Spider from a couple of years ago,
right,
or, things like that. So go ahead.
Well, I mean killing a character. I mean changing the relationship dynamics. I mean,
okay.
these are relatively young characters. They haven't been out there in the world very long.
True.
And I think, if somebody had taken on the Young Avengers book, immediately a lot of the ideas that we were talking about, there were writers who wanted to bring in new characters. There were writers who wanted to kill characters. They wanted to break up these little budding romances, and my instinct is always like, let's try to tell as much story with what we've got before. Do you know what I mean? Like, we barely know who these kids are. If you start making big changes and you start, I wanted to inch these kids toward each other really, really slowly in terms of their romantic relationships and the triangles, and I mean even within, and to be fair. The writers of Young Avengers Presents actually did get everybody together. There certainly weren't any couples really happening by the end of Young Avengers 12.
Right.
And the Young Avengers Presents, people got all those characters together in couples. So, and I'm picking up where they left off. But it's, there was certainly no mandate of you can't tell great stories with these characters. It was you can't, you got to put them back the way you found them, essentially.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't mean to get on a soapbox or anything, but I as a reader, it frustrates me when a new writer or an editorial team comes up with the blue Superman that we now look back on and go, what was that?
Looking at it now, it kind of looks crazy. Sure.
Yeah, you want your stories to be able to be read in 20 or 30 years' time and still make sense and not be so continuity bound that they that. They don't make sense out of context, I guess.
Understood. So, Greg Rucka went through the same problem. I don't mean to step on you, but with Batwoman, I mean, really having the opportunity that he did last year to really get into her story, there's an encounter with Batman, and my first question was that Bruce Wayne, is that Dick Grayson?
Right.
And he even said it's purposely left ambiguous so that 10 years from now, it's not going to be, oh, yeah, I remember that 2 years when X happened.
Exactly.
So, but go ahead.
You have to write defensively for, because we've all been reading comics long enough, we know how it feels to go back and read those old stories. So you don't want to be telling stories that are so continuity bound that they don't make sense 2 years from now. It's a tricky balancing act, because you also really do want to contribute to this one universe idea, because it's an awesome conceit. The fans love it. I love it. That it all takes place, in continuity, and that it all takes place, it's all happening right now, and, this story over here has an impact on that story over there, and I love that stuff, too, but it is a high-wire act that you walk as a writer.
Given your schedule, how much are you able to kind of stay in touch with things that are going on as they're happening?
Well, things are happening, because I'm a freelancer and not sort of part of... I'm not a monthly guy,
uh-huh.
And it's really the monthly guys who create what I guess we would call continuity. Because I'm not a monthly guy, I get the information, down the line sometimes, like from certain editors. So,
mm-hmm.
and comics is where behind the scenes is 3 to 6 months in advance of what you're reading.
Certainly.
Now. So I try to keep up with the bold strokes. And to stay as well informed as possible. But, oftentimes, I would stage, I think I staged a scene in Captain America's Brooklyn headquarters at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And then the day after I got the art back, I was reading an issue of Brian's book where it blew up. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's like, okay, well, let's. How, what are we going to do now? How do we fix this? So it's just something you deal with. And Tom Brevoort is such an extraordinary and experienced editor, and not prone to panic, that he really is a genius at how to address this stuff and continue moving forward and telling your story. But it's tricky because, you know, everybody's off in their own, you know, Bendisverse or Brubakerverse, and at the same time we're trying to tell this cohesive universal story. It's tricky.
And while you were busy working and weren't able to get to the characters, and when, you know, some of these other Young Avengers stories have popped up, is it kind of a mixed bag of, God, I wish it was me writing this stuff, but also being very excited about what other writers are doing with these characters at the same time?
Yeah, I am. I'm first of all, I live in such a little bubble, like my little TV bubble. I don't get out much, and I learned the hard way on you know, the first time around to stay off the internet as much as possible.
And okay.
So I really don't have a sense of how these characters were received, in many ways. I still can't believe that I'm being asked to write these characters and that people actually, you know, buy these books. I really don't have any sense of that at all. So the fact that there are other writers out there who actually want to write these characters is unbelievable to me. And yeah, I mean, there are times when you're reading other, you know, where the voices just don't, it's just not the way. Yeah, I mean, you can't help but sort of butt up against, oh, I wish, you know, either I wish I could have told that story, or why are we going in that direction?
Sure.
Let's go in this direction. But mostly it's just, you know, unbelievable gratitude and I can't even describe it. It's really moving to me that other people want to work with these characters. It's incredible.
There's one relationship that I it looks like you will be addressing to some degree, that given where both characters are today compared to where they were 5 years ago, I guess, or 6 years ago before Avengers disassembled, but like Wanda and the Vision, I think everybody is really, as much as the Wiccan Wanda, you know, connection is going to happen and stuff, certainly I think people are very excited to see what happens when this Vision encounters Wanda.
Yeah, well, I mean, and he's with Cassie now, so, you know, that could be a really awkward love triangle, if that, do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's just, and there's weird mom stuff, and
sure.
Are you my mom? Are you my girlfriend's wife? It's just weird. It's because our Vision really is essentially son of the Vision. So it's complex. I won't lie. But hopefully we deal with it in a way that will surprise some people and affect people. But it gets awkward. I mean, and for Cassie too, like, this is the woman who murdered her father.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's big. The Scarlet Witch is a real lightning rod for people. She really brings up a lot of stuff, and everybody's response is different in terms of how they feel about her and what they think should be done. So it creates nothing but conflict throughout the book. Just even the idea of going out and finding her creates havoc in all of these characters' lives, let alone, you know, once they actually find her.
Well, so. And also she's kind of been portrayed as more elemental than human. And I know, you know, being a mutant and certainly tapping into this reality-changing powers, that's a fair question. But I've seen in the written articles about this story, and you've expressed that we are going to get Wiccan's point of view, but are we able to get inside of Wanda's mind in the story as well and kind of feel what she's feeling? Or is it
Absolutely.
Really going to be through? Okay.
Go ahead. I mean, yeah, I really thought a lot about it because I love the character of the Scarlet Witch. And one of the things that I've been a little sad about is that, you know, this what happened to her in Disassembled and to an extent in House of M has happened to her throughout her entire career. She has been an incredibly powerful sort of portal. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
For other people to access and use. Like, Immortus did it to her, and she was possessed by the demon god K'thon. You know, it happens again and again, where she's sort of not in control of her destiny and really hasn't had her own point of view in quite some time. So when I started thinking about this story, I thought, is there any way to really get Wanda's point of view, you know, across. And ultimately, because she's, you know, she's the object of the story, not the subject of the story in a weird way. She's the Holy Grail, you know, finding her and then what happens to her once we find her. You can't really get in her head. It would be cheating to sort of switch, you know, omniscient narration from Wiccan, who's driving the story, to Wanda. But I feel like because Wiccan wants the answers to these questions the way we all want them, their interactions, we're going to get Wanda's point of view. We're just not going to be necessarily in her head. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
And she's got a lot to figure out herself. I mean, the world she comes back to is not the world she left. But yes, all those questions will be answered, and you will know how Wanda feels about this stuff. You definitely will. And I really think it's important that Wanda start to shape her own destiny, that she take responsibility for who she is and for what she did and what she's capable of, and that she steer her own course and not be, you know, and not be the Holy Grail for people anymore. You know, as somebody who's invested in the character, I love to see her go from being passive to being, you know, very, very active. However it ends up, whether she's a supervillain or whether she's a superhero or somewhere in between, I'm invested as a fan in her taking control of her own story.
Okay.
And
what about Simon Williams, Wonder Man? I mean, will he be in the story?
He's definitely invested in Wanda, and I don't want to give anything away.
Fair enough.
You know, everybody who has history with her, or who has an agenda or has had an agenda with her in the past, is probably going to show up, and they're probably going to have an agenda this time too.
Interesting.
So
that's great, man. This is very, I Claudius Sopranos kind of, the epic family where really everyone has their own little, you know, mission, and it sounds great. It really does. This is very exciting.
You're very kind.
Hey, man.
I hope you enjoy it.
Interesting to jump back with an epic as opposed to just, hey, here's Alan and Jim. We all love them and stuff with another story. Was the idea from Marvel to say, hey, if we want you guys to come back with something big as opposed to, like I said, what everybody would have been, I think, very satisfied with, and that's a third story.
Well, it was definitely, it was about telling this particular story. This was, Jim and I, when I first pitched the series, this was one of the, 9 or 12 arcs that I had thrown out. And it was based on what had happened to Disassembled. House of M hadn't even happened yet.
Right.
So that was always a story I wanted to tell. And then House of M sort of happened, I guess, as we were wrapping up Young Avengers. And suddenly the Search for the Scarlet Witch story took on, much sort of deeper and graver implications. Like now, if Wiccan and Speed go looking for her, now it means something completely different. Because she's, to some people, she's caused this what people are calling a mutant genocide. So it's automatically going and looking for her is going to set off so many alarm bells throughout the Marvel Universe that there's no way to tell this story and just have it be a Young Avengers story. I mean, it could have been, and I think when we started, we didn't know what to call it. For me, it was Young Avengers: The Search for the Scarlet Witch. But I guess because so many of the characters turned out to be Avengers, and as I said, former Avengers, and at one point the X-Men were going to have, it was going to be like an Avengers X-Men Young Avengers crossover.
Okay.
Like, we were trying to represent exactly what it was, but also to make it, to sort of get the biggest audience for it, because it does have an impact on the larger Marvel Universe. You know, the Young Avengers audience is a subset of the Marvel Universe audience, so I think at a certain point, just because it had far-reaching implications, the guys at Marvel felt like, okay, better to sell this as an Avengers miniseries, because that's really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, but it definitely, the story didn't change. What we called it sort of changed as the story developed. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah, but it was every decision that's been made has been story-driven, which is not market-driven, which has been great.
Is there, and again, this will just be you and Jim as far as doing the story. There won't be tie-ins, there won't be crossover issues, or will there be?
Well, no. I mean, it wasn't conceived that way, and because of the way that Jim and I work, and because it's bimonthly, it would have been nearly impossible, I think, to do that. So it's just us. There's this one little bonus story that the X office was generous enough to allow me to do in Uncanny X-Men 526. It's an 8-page short story that I'm doing with Olivier Coipel, and it's a little tie-in. It's sort of a prelude, actually, even though I think it comes out a week or two after Children's Crusade number one comes out. But it sort of addresses, you know, the mutant. It comes at our story from the mutant angle a little bit.
Okay.
And sets some of that stuff up and hopefully adds a little depth. But that's really the only sort of tie-in that's not in the book itself. The book is really self-contained. You know, all the implications of the book, the sort of fallout from the book, all the other writers who are involved in the Marvel Universe are very generously waiting until we're all done to sort of implement those in their stuff. So the stuff that happens will have an effect, but it won't be in the other books until after we've wrapped, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely, and I have a feeling that a lot of fans are going to breathe a sigh of relief because those who want to invest in the full story will get what they want by following you and Jim every other month, and also it won't impinge on what, you know, everyone has been saying from the front office at Marvel what the Heroic Age was going to be, and that is, let's focus on each individual book, let's let all the creators tell their own stories and share a backdrop, but not be directly invested in the events of each other's books as they have been for the last few years. This is good. I think that's a smart way to get the X readers aware of your story in a nice little 8-page thing and say, okay, if you want to continue this, follow, you know, Alan and Jim over here, and meanwhile, Matt will do his thing over here at, the regular Uncanny book.
Exactly. And I'm grateful to them for giving me the opportunity because I'd never written an X-Men story before, and it was really fun.
How about all these characters? I mean, yeah, how many characters are you touching for the first time in this story?
Quite a few.
Cool.
Quite a few. I've had my work cut out for me research-wise, and I'm one of those guys. I feel like I have to read everything before I can write a character.
Okay.
It drives Tom crazy, but it's been, there are a lot of people I'm writing for the first time, and it's been an education. It really has, but really fun, and I've enjoyed reading doing all the research stuff. It's been great.
Was there a number of characters that you hadn't, you know, even as a casual reader and stuff, you know, were really kind of like, okay, let me, you know, find out the deal behind this guy, or were...
Yeah, there are a couple. I mean, I gravitate toward characters that I already have sort of an emotional response to. So I tend to focus on those characters. I'm a little bit, if I don't have, you know, plus we've got so many characters already just with the Young Avengers and the Avengers that, Tom has tried to discipline me to stay away from. Because the temptation is, wow, I would love to see Jim draw, you know, Tigra. How about that, you know? but I don't know that Tigra is necessarily essential to this story, so I don't know that you'll be seeing Tigra. There's definitely the temptation to ask Jim to draw all of, you know, every Marvel Universe character. I have to sort of watch that. Mainly just because the space is so limited and I want to be able to give all of the characters stage time, I've tried to really narrow it down to the ones I know best.
Okay. And because it is a bi-monthly, Alan, I wonder how that affects breaking the story, because I can appreciate, you know, from a scheduling standpoint with Jim's art, that you guys do need that kind of lead time to really be able to, you know, kind of maintain a schedule. But yeah, from, you know, leaving each issue satisfying, I should say, for 60 days, that's got to be its own challenge.
It definitely is. I mean, you want to, you know, we set up this thing with Young Avengers where we were having a lot of fun with cliffhangers and reversals and surprises, and people seem to really respond to that stuff. So, you know, I'm trying to sort of keep that up with this book, and to give people, you know, enough story per issue, make sure that the story's dense enough without crowding Jim. So it's a definite balancing act for us. But I think it's ultimately such a simple and emotional story that people won't necessarily get lost. The things that are driving these characters are so elemental and so emotional that I think you'll be able to get right back in to the flow of things from between months.
Okay. And I'm looking at some of the preview art that's been released so we can gather some of the characters that are going to be used. based on, you know, these images and stuff. And I see Spider-Man in there. Had you written Spider-Man prior to this?
I have written Spider-Man in Young Avengers. He was part of that Kree Skrull War story we did.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Avengers.
All right.
I basically picked up those Avengers, minus Spider-Woman and the Sentry. But it's essentially that group of Avengers. And at the time, you know, when I started this, I didn't know which Avenger was going to end up where, honestly.
Certainly.
I didn't know who was going to be an Avenger or a new Avenger. So it really was sort of just who's already invested in these kids? You know, who makes sense, you know, here? If something's going on with these kids, who's going to be there trying to deal with it? And it just made sense for it to be the Avengers they had worked with during the Kree Skrull adventure at the end of Young Avengers. So that's who we start with in this book.
Very cool. No, this is very interesting, man. I'm definitely looking forward to it. It's going to be a nice cap to the holiday week and everything. And I think next Thursday everyone's going to be very excited to start reading your story, man. So this is very cool.
I'm excited. I can't wait to see it.
And everyone's relieved, too, because another thing that I think was surprising to read initially was that you were thinking maybe this was going to be the last time that you and Jim would work on the Young Avengers.
Yeah, I really just wanted to get out of the way. You know what I mean? I felt, because my schedule's so weird, I thought, you know what, they're allowing me to do this, to tell this incredible story with Jim, and then I should just leave. Then I should just go away and not bother these people anymore. So that was the original. That was the original plan, was just to do it and get out, and let other people tell these stories. But I really have fallen back in love with these characters, and there's just so much to do.
Excellent.
So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. I don't think I'm ever going to be a monthly guy. It just isn't. It doesn't seem to be possible for me, given the way that I write and the amount of stuff that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if Marvel's cool with me being able to write these things a year in advance, you know, and them happening sort of self-contained outside of continuity, but you know, in this little bubble.
Sure.
Then I'd love to keep writing Marvel comics and to tell Young Avengers stories. So we'll see if we can figure it out. And hopefully after people read Children's Crusade, they'll still want me to do that. So. I take nothing for granted, John. Nothing.
Understood. No, I understand, man. But no, I think if you guys are able to make this kind of compromise, I think it would be great, because I think there are just as many screenwriters that have tried comics in the last 10 years that we do want to see back as money as that. Okay, fine, they did their thing. They tried. It maybe succeeded or failed. But I think you're on a hell of a streak, man. And I think, like I say, I think people were very excited to hear that you were coming back. So, you know, I mean, every you know, I know you had scheduling problems with Wonder Woman and stuff, and I realized that. And that's the thing. I think some really good writers had that kind of issue. But this might be the way to solve it, as you say. What's wrong with that? And then it's the best of both worlds. It's a win-win. It can fit in your schedule. And as opposed to making you guys adhere to a monthly schedule, you know, find a way of you guys being able to still tell cool stories. Because the aftermarket of the trades, and now even in the digital market and stuff, who's to say that, you know, this shouldn't continue?
It's true. I mean, I know that there are a lot of comics fans who are against the whole issue of writing for trades. But, you know, you just want to tell great stories. And if you can tell, you know, if you can tell a great X-Men story or a great Avengers story or a great Young Avengers story that is, you know, as I said, self-contained, that and you put everybody back at the end, you know, the way you found them, it doesn't mean you haven't grown the characters internally. It doesn't mean you haven't excited people and thrilled people and surprised people and moved people and done all the things that a good story is supposed to do. But, you know, you haven't blown things up in a way that makes it, you know, difficult for the next guy to come along and tell. I don't know. I think there's a way to do it. I'd like to continue to try, almost like little movies. You know, you come in and you do your Marvel movie, and people can enjoy it. And then once it's done, you move on. And Mark Miller works that way.
Certainly.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, and I guess Warren Ellis is doing that to a certain degree in Astonishing X-Men. And they're great stories. You know, they're really, really fun stories. So I'd love to be able to do that. Right, the Young Avengers is such a continuity-bound property. You know, it's so deeply rooted in Avengers continuity. It's I don't know that I would be able to necessarily do that with Young Avengers, but maybe. I hope to someday.
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't know. I mean, because then again, they are born from the seeds of Avengers history. But as you say, maybe there is a way to kind of keep them, you know, okay, this is the next story in their evolution or something. And again, if you're given the broad strokes, maybe there's a way to do this. I certainly hope so.
I would love to. I'd love to be able to do like a Young Avengers story. That, you know, someone who's never read Young Avengers or Avengers could just pick it up and get these characters and go on the ride and enjoy it. And, that'd be... I would love to try that. That'd be fun.
Excellent, man. Well, this is great. And it's fun to compare what's going on now in comics to what we've seen the last few years in television as well, because, you know, I mentioned the digital market and that, and that's a question that certainly came up for you guys during the writer's strike and this way that people are consuming television in a way that hadn't been consumed before. And just, you know, how the audience is being counted. And, I think the good news is Grays continues to be very entertaining and very funny. And I spoke to my sister before we got started. and one thing that she wanted to say was that overall, she's really enjoyed the fact that you're able to come up with new tense moments during surgery for these people. It's funny. I was watching the finale right before we talked as well, just to kind of, you know, catch up. And on the one hand, I thought it was excellent tension, but I couldn't help but laugh as well, because as you say, we'll see how things turn when we get back next season. But there was that feeling of, I'm performing surgery at gunpoint. Oh, really? Well, I'm performing surgery while I'm having a miscarriage. And all I could see were, in my mind, I'm like, all right, there's 10 million houses of women right now screaming at each one of these revelations. And it was killing me, man. I thought that was great. It was very, very entertaining. And very honestly, you guys kept the tension going. But I couldn't help but smile as well and say, this is really fun. So,
it gets tough, man. I mean, you know, we've got usually 3 medical cases per episode and 24 episodes per season, and you got to come up with stuff, man. New ways to keep them on their toes in surgery. And you got to hand it to Shonda Rhimes, because a gunpoint and a miscarriage, it's going to be hard to top that, I got to say. How do you do, you know, unless there's a nuclear warhead in the... You know, we've sort of done the bomb thing, so.
That's true, and I was going to say, maybe the 24 route is the next option for next season for Grays.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what happens.
I was almost wondering, because in the last couple of weeks, there have been rumors that maybe Patrick Dempsey might make a great Doctor Strange, and I think that's fantastic, and when I saw him being shot, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I'm like, maybe this is his exit so he could go on with his movie career.
Loves Doctor Strange. He absolutely loves Doctor Strange.
That's really cool.
Yeah, he would make a great one. We've talked about it quite a bit, actually. He's there through, I think, season 8, definitely. And then he's up for renegotiation. But there's nothing to stop Patrick from doing movies in the summer.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. He'd make an excellent Doctor Strange.
I think he would, too. Patrick's such an amazing actor. I'd love to see him do that.
You know, I give him a lot of credit, and who the hell am I? But honestly, just as a guy that grew up watching him from being the teen movie person that he was to the current television star that he is, I give him a lot of credit, because, you know, who knows what's true and what's false, but he sounded like kind of a petulant kid that kind of, you know, figured out how to be a cool adult and has, you know, really grown, I think, as an actor. I think everyone thought he was incredibly talented from the start, but I won't deny, as just being, like I said, a 20-something watching him 20 years ago, I'm like, all right, enough with this kid. Jesus.
Yeah.
But honestly, I really grew to like him on Grays, and when they said Doctor Strange, I'm like, he would be awesome as Doctor Strange, and I really have done a 180, and I am now a Patrick Dempsey fan. There, I've admitted it.
You know what? I mean, I know it's probably... Patrick has such extraordinary range. There's nothing that he can't do. And in TV and movies, it's so difficult to find a guy who's as handsome as he is and as charismatic as he is, who projects as much intelligence as he does, and is so good at comedy. Like, he is that guy. I don't know if you ever got to see his Will and Grace's, but he did such an extraordinary run on Will and Grace.
Oh, I didn't know he was on Will and Grace. That's very funny.
He did a 3-episode arc as one of Will's boyfriends.
Okay.
And I thought for sure Patrick was going to have his own you know, half hour.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, he outshone everybody on that in that cast.
Wow.
That cast was really good.
Shit, yeah.
So yeah, no, I've been blown away by him. I think people, you know, kind of take him for granted sometimes a little bit, but he's the real thing.
And you know, I got to say too, looking back at was it Bye Bye Love? Was that his big? I know he was in the Heartbreak Kid and
Can't Buy Me Love.
Can't Buy Me Love. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Can't Buy Me, you know, it was on, I think it was on like Oxygen or something. I'm flipping on a Saturday afternoon. And I remember seeing that in the theater. And I really did enjoy that film back then. And now it is such a great, like, fun 80s and early, I don't even remember if it was 80s or early 90s.
Yeah.
But just, you know, the fashions, everything about that film is great. And I guess it was a Dennis Dugan film, wasn't it? Didn't he direct it?
I think that's true. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie, but I think you're right.
And that's the guy, for people listening who don't know who Dennis Dugan is. Of course, he's Richie Brockelman, being the TV detective fans that we all are. But also is Adam Sandler's, one of Adam Sandler's chief collaborators, especially initially, directing a lot of Sandler's early and best movies, Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison and the like. So that's really, you know, I mean, I love that movie. And, yeah, Patrick's incredibly funny in that. And now is a very funny and has grown into a very funny mature adult, and it is great. And yeah, much like Downey being Tony Stark, I really think that, you know, Patrick would be an excellent Doctor Strange, and I could really see that succeeding in a similar way that Iron Man has.
It would certainly be fun. I don't know, maybe they'll find a way to introduce the character in one of those other movies and see what happens.
Yeah. No, yeah. Very cool, man. And yeah, boy, yeah, you put us through the ringer with him. Was he going to live or die? And poor Meredith. And poor, poor Christina. And finally, and my sister wants you to know, once again, she's happy that, you know, Meredith's balls are continuing to grow, and that's great. And Christina's balls grew a little bit this year with her at gunpoint and everything, finally.
Yeah.
Stepping out of the heart surgeon's shadow and doing it on her own. Way to go, Christina.
It's true. How do we top this for next season?
No, this it was fun, man. It was very fun. It was very interesting. What else? Oh, my sister said Little Gray, not sniveling like she used to. She's gotten stronger. She was excited about that. And my sister really likes Evan. She really enjoys Evan's character for the last couple of years. And from his introduction to really, you know, what's been going on with him, with Christina and the other heart surgeon as well. I mean, just their whole story. So that's kind of neat.
Awesome.
Yeah. No, you're getting good grades. You're getting good.
So your sister has no complaints. This is what I'm hearing.
No, she, like I said, these were all positive things that she said. But she really, especially in the finale, she's like, "Oh, the gunman, that was really cool."
Oh, good.
So
good. Well, please thank her for me.
I have to...
On behalf of the writing staff of Grey's Anatomy.
You know, and I honestly, you guys really have a great ensemble, both behind the scenes and in front of the camera, because all the different changes that have happened in the cast, you guys seem to be able to roll with it. And, you know, continue to chug along. And, again, everybody just kind of comes to play and, you know, great stories. I mean, the Chief's arc this season has been so great.
Oh, good.
And, yeah, I really enjoyed him coming out of rehab and the flashback episode from a couple weeks ago, you know, from the few weeks before the end, now a couple months ago. But I thought that was a really good episode as well. And I he's always the Chief, even though he's not the Chief right now. He's still the Chief. So he's, you know, he's awesome. He's a great actor, and I enjoy seeing him on the show.
He is a great actor.
So.
He really is.
Up and down, man. Very cool. Still very funny and still very exciting.
Thank you. Very kind of you.
That's cool. And, I mean, are you still in for the long haul? Everything cool? Because I know sometimes you guys move from show to show, but you've been there for years now.
Well, I've been there for 4 seasons, and actually this past season was my last season.
There you go. Okay, you see, Alan, I knew there was something in the air. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't make any sort of formal announcement, but I was reaching the end of my fourth year, and we were up for contract renegotiations, and it just felt like time for me to go off and do my own thing for a while and maybe take some time away from Shondaland and tell some of my own stories, and they were great about it. They were incredibly loving and supportive, and I'm gonna be there a lot this year, and I'm gonna be hanging out with the cast and the staff, and we're all gonna stay close. But it was just time to sort of do something else, because I felt like I just needed I needed some time away. Do you know what I mean? Just to get some perspective and recharge. So yeah, which makes more time for comics, which has been great.
Well, that's good, but I'm also curious now, because this is you know, and I see it in radio, too, and I can't help it. Every time I speak to anybody in media, whether it's Garib Sheamus at Wizard Magazine or people that I've met that work for Oprah and, you know, people like yourself, television screenwriters, other radio people, what do you think? I mean, honestly, this is like kind of a brave new world and a new era that we're all entering in, and the ground keeps literally shifting under our feet. And on the one hand, I'm excited by all the prospects, but by the same token, all the traditional places for episodic television, traditional radio, they're expanding, but they're also in the same ways. There are more opportunities, but for, frankly, less money in some cases. And it seems to be less money to play with.
Yeah, very true. Well, on the plus side, it's forcing people to be more inventive. It's forcing people to be more creative. It is giving people more freedom. For TV writers, especially the cable playing field, that whole sort of area has really opened up as the place to go. You know, if you've got a really strong point of view, if you've got something that doesn't necessarily fit into the strictures of network television, and that's creatively, I think that's where a lot of the best TV is happening right now.
I agree.
And, you know, I mean, the music industry is falling apart in the same way, but in a way that system, you know, the old system isn't viable. You know, artists are finally, they're not getting signed to record labels, which pretty much don't exist anymore, but they are finally in charge of, you know, their own lives and careers and their publishing, and, you know, it's definitely a trade-off. So I'm curious to see. I think we're getting great stuff, great content out of it, but it's true, financially it is much riskier and much scarier. You know, from a TV standpoint, it's really hard to do 24 episodes a season. So I really love the cable model of doing anywhere from like 8 to 13. Even though it's less money, you can really spend more time on each episode, and I don't know, you can really allow your voice full range. So I'm personally excited to go and see what that's all about. But I agree, it is a scary time.
Do you have some? I mean, and I'm not asking you to show your cards, but do you have some show ideas that you would like to explore?
I do. I'm currently developing two shows at the moment.
Fantastic.
With different studios and networks, and unfortunately, I can't say anything about them. But I'm really in love with both of them, and excited about the people so far that I'm working with, and I feel really, really lucky to have projects that I'm enjoying and that other people seem to be responding to. So. With any luck, they'll get written and shot and make it to the air. But for now, it's amazing just to be able to work on them and develop them.
That's great, man. And you know, should they? I've seen it happen before with you know, some of our other mutual friends. That, you know, when you are ready to talk about it and, you know, a date is given, I hope you'll come back and we can talk about it, because I am. I'm incredibly fascinated, and I feel for, you know, some of these shows that don't make it, even after, you know, a network has invested in them and shot a pilot and stuff, and then we don't even end up seeing the pilot sometimes.
Yeah, and in this environment, you'll see maybe two episodes and then they'll pull it. You know, it's just so risky right now.
And again, I hope that, you know, it is basic cable that you have your opportunities, because if anything, it does seem like they are at least given that initial 8 or 13 episode season to explore one story before leaving, as opposed to the two and out that we do see on network television. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, I'm really curious to see what's going to happen, and excited about it. You know, for me at this point, it's just about building shows that are worthy of having people watch them and tune in. So I'm at that stage where we're building it and trying to make it as good and as compelling and as essential as possible.
Very cool. What are some of the basic cable shows that you've been enjoying? You know, what and network television, if you've had time to kind of explore what's out there.
Yeah, I don't mean to poo-poo network television. I love my Thursday nights on NBC. Community and The Office and 30 Rock and the one that I'm forgetting that I'm going to be.
Parks and Recreation?
Parks and Rec, which is arguably the best show on television. But on cable, Justified is amazing. I consider Go ahead.
I was going to say, I like that show, too, although it's funny. I was talking to Jason Aaron in an episode that has just aired recently, but for listeners. But and I have to admit, maybe, you know, and you're a, aren't you a Southerner? Aren't you from the South?
I'm from Oklahoma, but I don't know that I would call myself a Southerner.
All right. Well, I was going to say, because honestly, I feel like a Northerner watching this going, oh, they're really hitting all the strokes. I go, but it almost seems too red state. Like, I love Timothy Oliphant, and I won't deny it. I find it very entertaining. But I was asking Jason, and Jason said, yeah, they almost kind of are too authentic to, you know, almost bordering on stereotype. But what do you think?
I'm really enjoying it. I'm still a little behind because I've had to sort of catch up since Grays.
Sure.
We wrapped on Grays, but I really like everybody involved in that show, and I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
No, I won't deny it. So what other shows? Go ahead.
Well, I consider Friday Night Lights to be a cable show, and I still think Friday Night Lights is the best show on television.
I know it's obscene that they can't. I don't know, man. It just shows you the fragmented media world that we're currently in.
Yeah, a world where Friday Night Lights has not been nominated for any, you know, writing or acting Emmys. I mean, at all. I think it's won the casting Emmy for the first season, and that was it. It's not even been nominated since.
Crazy.
Not that the Emmys are the be-all and the end-all, but I think it might be the best drama in the history of television. I feel so strongly about
it. Wow.
It really is a powerful, for me, it's an incredibly powerful show. It's one of those shows you just wish you had written, you know. I wish I had gotten a chance to work with those people and work on that show. It's just magical to me. And that NBC does second run on that, but DirecTV really came in and rescued that show. So if anybody hasn't seen it, it's on DVD.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it is an incredible show, and it was a great movie as well. And that's what I think is even more interesting is that, you know, Peter Berg has succeeded both, you know, from a film and TV standpoint in a way that hasn't happened in a long time. I mean, you know, we used to have the MASHes and things like that, but and I mean, certainly MASH, I think the movie and the television show became very different things. But I think everybody on that show, and I'm forgetting her name now, from Spin City and the Ed Burns movie, the brothers.
Connie Britton?
Yeah, Connie Britton, of course, who's just incredible on that show.
She really is. I mean, that marriage, that's the best marriage I've ever seen represented in any media. I mean, that's an incredible dynamic between those two actors, and the writing is just sublime. Everything about that show, there's not a single element. And that cast, it's an extraordinary cast.
The other thing I was going to say, too, is sometimes I think the comic book companies, with the fact that they are dealing with six-part stories, sometimes regard the monthlies as, well, you know, it's like episodic television. And it's like, actually, it's not. Because as you say, certainly in the case of Grey's and the other network television shows, you're really dealing with 24 stories that can stand on their own, but then do tell the bigger seasonal arc. And while I understand that, you know, in comics, we do have the opportunity to read and you know, read the occasional 12-issue story, 6-part story, in your case with the Children's Crusade, 9 parts, it really is the one story. And it is tough breaking those monthly, or in your case, bi-monthly chapters into its own satisfying thing. And I know we addressed it in terms of how you're tackling it from a reading from a writing standpoint. But would you say so from a reading standpoint? I think they really are different animals.
They really, really are. I mean, you've got, you know, Battlestar Galactica is a great example of how to do it right. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I don't know if you know that show.
I love that show.
But again, cable, you know, and one of the finest television shows ever, in my opinion.
Completely agree.
But you know, you've got your A story that's sort of self-contained for that episode, you know. But at the same time, you've got like B and C and D stories. You know, the D story in one episode, 3 episodes down the line, is going to become the A story in a way that sneaks up on you and surprises you. But you're already invested in it because you've spent like 4 episodes, you know, noticing it around the edges. And I'm just, they do a masterful job of it. But at the same time, you really, you know, every episode is its own, with the exception of the two-parters.
Right.
Every episode is its own book, its own novel in a way.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I feel a little guilty in that I wish Children's Crusade was like that, but it's just such a big story. It is one great big story. It's more like a fairy tale in that you get chapters, you know. It's And old school comics, it wasn't like that. You got chapters, but they were 3 or 4 or 5 pages with, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 panels.
Sure.
And now, you know, 4 panels a page and 22 of them, and, you know, there's just not a lot of room.
Understood.
I don't want to sound like I've been put in a box. This is a box of my own making. So I'll try it a little differently next time if the story, you know, dictates it.
I'm excited too, as you say, when you compare it to fairy tales. I think back to Jim Chung's work on Scion for Crosschamp.
Yeah. How great was that?
And, you know, exactly. I mean, it was such a great adventure story, but by the same token, really did have that fairy tale vibe to it, literally, yeah. Of the prince and the castle and the kind of, you know, knights in armor kind of feel to it and everything. I thought it was just fantastic.
Yeah, we're definitely drawing on some of that stuff for this book.
Well, you can't help it. Wicked almost seems to be kind of a knight errant when you see him in his outfit and everything. So, yeah, I can appreciate that.
We've got witches and castles and, you know, fun stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And lords and houses, you know, houses and everything. Absolutely.
And
man.
Giants. We have giants.
How about Magneto, man? He's going to be an interesting player in this story.
Yeah, he's, you know, especially where he is right now in his own story. Because he's, you know, he's just convinced everybody that he's actually one of the good guys through Second Coming. And, I don't know if people are going to feel that way if he goes looking for Wanda. Do you know what I mean?
Indeed. Absolutely.
I think everybody's going to be questioning his motives. Is he acting as a father? Is he acting as somebody who'd like to get his hands on the most powerful force in the universe? It's going to be interesting. And his relationship to the kids is going to be interesting, too. To his quote-unquote grandchildren.
Yes.
In fact, they are his grandchildren.
And what about Quicksilver?
Well, what about Quicksilver? I can't wait to see. What about Quicksilver?
Absolutely, man. That guy, Jesus Christ, that guy has just gone through hell for the last 6 years. And some of it, of course, his own making. But it is. He is a fascinating character to watch. And, I was a fan back in the Marvel superhero cartoon days. So I always kind of rooted for Quicksilver and really didn't come across him being a dick until, like, the 80s and 90s.
It's true.
And it's like, hey, man, why do you shit on Quicksilver? He's cool.
He was, you know, very possessive of Wanda in those early Avengers stories.
Yes.
Not very nice to the Vision. That sort of set the tone for him becoming, you know, the big jerk he suddenly became. he's an interesting character. And again, you know, good guy and bad guy. It depends on the day. So, you know, that turns out to be a very central theme in the story.
I'm glad you're back, Alan. We all missed you.
You're very kind to me, John. I'm very, very grateful.
Hey, man, it's my pleasure, and I'm grateful that you answer my emails and accept my calls. So it all works out for the both of us, man.
I love, you know, being able to get together on the phone every 4 or 5 years.
Exactly. Well, hopefully, honestly, depending on your schedule, as the story progresses, maybe we can set something up mid-story, you know, which I guess would be in 10 months, so.
Exactly. We'd almost be on schedule. I would love nothing more because there's nothing I love more than talking about comics. So,
hey, what do you think, as we wrap up, what do you think of, you know, just like I said, the digital market and all the different changes that are going on right now in comics? What do you think?
I got to say, as long as there's compensation, you know, proper compensation for the talent, and this is probably going to get me in trouble, but I'm really excited about it.
Understood.
My best friend gave me an iPad for my birthday.
Oh, terrific.
And I have been reading comics on my iPad, and it's kind of amazing. I really love it. You can go from panel to panel in a way that really allows you to appreciate, you know, the full page or just the panel. And I got to admit, like, having the space back, not having a room full of long boxes.
Here, here.
That's super enticing to me.
Understood.
I'm sad about the collectability thing, but I kind of feel like that's gone away, you know, at a certain point. Certainly, you know, Golden Age and Silver Age and certain Bronze Age stuff is always going to be collectible, but that part I'm sad about, because I do think it's going to go in that direction. I think the printed versions, you know, it's just sort of inevitable that we're going to go digital.
I agree.
But with the convenience of it and the space saving and how beautiful it is, I don't know. I'm excited. Is it wrong to be excited? I should be ashamed of myself.
No, I think the only people that obviously are afraid are the same people that were afraid about the changes in music. And that's unfortunately the mom and pop stores.
Yeah, it's the retailers. That's the horrible thing.
And I won't deny, man. And I've said this to other people that obviously are as concerned about the retailers as the retailers themselves. I can appreciate that because I liked as a kid having stores that I could go to shop music. It was something to do. It got me out of the house. It was just fun to browse. And I don't think the digital browsing experience is the same. And that's a shame that we are losing that, and that eventually we probably will lose it from a book standpoint as well.
Yeah, just the community aspect that used to stem from that.
Absolutely.
Too, I retailers are going to have to. I mean, it's going to require a diversification that I don't even know if it's possible. I don't even know what that would look like. But that part is that's going to be a huge blow. If it comes to that.
Well, and I'm hoping that enough strong stores that are smart and do diversify and also, still provide a reason for community and stuff are able to exist. The only thing that I think, and I'll be curious as a fan of music as you are, your opinion of this, there is something about tangible art that is different than having a screensaver and having a piece of art on your wall. And I wonder if comics, even in book form, still might have some sort of appeal depending on the package that it's in and the way that it is displayed as something tangible as opposed to something on an iPad or a computer screen.
No, it's true. I mean, when you said that, I immediately thought about the absolute editions of things, the ultimate editions of things.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Where the actual artifact becomes a piece of art in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
There'll probably always be a market for that, being able to read Sandman or, a new X-Men omnibus and have that experience, you're not going to be able to replicate that. So I don't know. I don't know if it'll be monthlies. I don't know if it'll be these great collections that people buy. I don't know.
And I don't know if kids, real kids, younger than 16, would care about those things because I see it in my own nephew. My sister's youngest son is 13 and can't stand reading books but loves reading online.
Wow.
So, yeah. And so, again, it's what you're exposed to as a kid and whatever habits you develop then, I think, dictate whatever you spend your money on in the future and stuff. So, yeah, maybe we are seeing the last generations of true book lovers. I don't know as far as the actual product, the physical product as opposed to, again, the digital stories.
The artifacts, as it were.
Yes. Ooh, very, very lofty.
I know. Well, no, it just made me sad because it already puts a distance between, the reader and the actual book if they become artifacts. They're relics from a previous generation.
Ooh, it's like Rod Taylor in The Time Machine when all the books crumble in his hands.
Now I'm sad.
It's prophetic.
I was so happy.
Oh, man.
Sad.
Yeah, I bummed you out. All right. Sorry, dude.
No, we had to touch on serious matters. I take it back about the digital revolution. I take it all back. Stupid iPod. Stupid iPad, rather.
Well, man, good luck with the book, and it comes out as we're recording this or broadcasting this. It comes out this week, so looking forward to it. And whatever your future television plans are, keep it up, man, because you got a great track record behind you with some very successful shows that absolutely have Alan Heinberg's fingerprints on them. And very excited to see what's coming next from you, both on television and in the comics.
Thank you, sir. That means a lot.
There you go, Alan Heinberg. Make sure you check out Avengers, The Children's Crusade. The story starts this week, Thursday, and that'll be the first day that it's out in stores. We'll be checking out this story. It's 9 parts, bi-monthly. So as Alan says, it might be a while since we talked to him again. What the hell, man? I don't know why we keep doing that. But now let's switch gears and talk as our Road to San Diego coverage continues with a discussion with Patrick Scullin, the creator of Super Siblings and its sister publication, Meet the Clarks. You can find them both at supersiblingscomics.com. And this is a talk about Patrick's webcomic and his small press comic and his plans for San Diego. I think you're going to enjoy it. Well, it's a pleasure meeting you, and thank you very much for providing me copies of Meet the Clarks and Super Siblings. And it was a good opportunity to get a good feel of the characters. And what I like especially is that I think you're very adept at taking the usual kind of comic strip form, but stringing enough together to create a story. How much planning is there to make sure that, each individual strip is its own little joke, but also tying it to the bigger story.
Right. Well, you know, thanks, John, for having me on the show and everything, too. But to answer your question, I tend to go by, just fly by the seat of my pants when I do the webcomic. It just kind of flows. It's kind of like a journal of my life to a certain degree.
Do you have a sister?
I do. A pesky little sister.
Oh, there you go.
And so, you know, when I find things that are funny that happen around me, I just take notes, and sometimes they wind up as a comic strip.
Super Siblings is brother and sister. There's
yes.
Conrad and Courtney. And
yes.
Conrad is Scout, and he's a good guy. And Courtney mm-hmm. is Banshee, and she's evil.
Yes.
And neither knows the other secret.
He screams a lot.
There you go. And yeah, this is like Dexter and Dee Dee in reverse.
Yeah, exactly.
You're dealing from your own family dynamic, so, you know, you're the hero in your own comic book life, so therefore Scout's the good guy, and your sister's the frustration.
Exactly. And basically, as it goes together, too, one of the key parts is that they don't know each other's secret identity. So they've become archenemies unwittingly, you know, even though they're sibling rivals at home.
And how long have you been doing the strip, first of all?
It's going on for about 2.5 years now. And it comes together in two forms. I have the weekly web comic, which is kind of a satire on their ordinary life with their parents. And the comic book itself is more their adventures as their alter egos. And those are longer page stories that come together every few months. I'm able to finish one.
Okay. And do you still offer it, though, online as, you know, in strip form, the Super Siblings thing, or is that purely a comic book?
I've tried to separate the two. So you can read the webcomic every week, and then the books I keep contained in the comic books that I sell either as print comics or digital downloads.
Very good. And and what day of the week is a new strip posted usually? Do you have a set day?
Usually Mondays.
Okay.
If I get my act together.
How much of it, well, you say you fly by the seat of your pants, so I mean, do you have a general outline or do you, you know,
For the comic stories, I do have an outline that I follow and I kind of script out where it's going. But for the webcomic itself, I just get a few weeks ahead with some ideas for jokes, and then as I finish them, I try to get a little bit of a buffer, but I usually wind up working on them the night before.
Okay. The father is his own kind of geek as well. I mean, there's obviously superhero humor between the brother and sister, but yeah, I would say that their dad obviously is a big geek.
Yeah, and in reality, he's probably more my alter ego than anything else. I actually have a 12-year-old and 8-year-old, and I kind of picture them as the two protagonists and antagonists in the story.
Okay. That's funny. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, dinner table, you're taking notes while they're going through their usual routine?
Exactly. And they're pretty funny, so I steal all their material.
What does your wife think of all this?
Oh, she's the one scowling in the background thinking I'm crazy.
Well, I saw you guys getting ready for Halloween. The Clark's getting ready for Halloween.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, now Dad's already with his Captain Kirk outfit, and he's trying to convince her to get in the green-skinned slave girl outfit.
Yeah, I haven't quite convinced her to do that yet. I'm still working on that one. But whenever I go to Comic-Con, she says, you know, you found your people. So she says, go have fun. So
has she gone to San Diego yet herself?
I took her once. And she was shocked, but had a good time. I told her to stay close because I spoke nerd, so kept her close by.
How many times have you had tables in small press at San Diego?
Let's see. I think this is my third year in small press. I had a table in another area in Artist Alley before, but third year in small press.
Okay, so how many cons altogether have you been? You know, they're just, you know, exhibiting.
Yeah, well, I've been at Comic-Con. I think this will be my fifth year. And I've done a few other local shows in Anaheim, Wizard World, and some other things here in California.
Very good. Were you at the last Wizard World Anaheim?
I was.
Uh-huh. How was that?
I had a good time. It was a little small, so I'm not sure, you know, what the future holds. But
yeah.
I do like supporting the local shows.
Well, and that's the thing, and I'm not asking you to, you know, be nasty or anything like that, but I think we're all interested in how this new version of the Wizard shows is going. You know, Chicago is about to have its second Wizard show since, you know, they kind of changed the show and made it more of a pop culture show and a memorabilia show than a real comics first and comics absolutely show.
Yeah, I got in trouble for taking a picture of Adam West at the Anaheim show.
Understood. Yeah, you know, and that is, I kind of get it because of the way these things are set up. I mean, the promoters have to dole out, you know, so much money, and, you know, to kind of cover the actors, and then they're there literally cranking out autographs to make money to not only match that, but hopefully go even above it or whatever and really make an even bigger profit. And it's, you know, it kind of, I get it, but it also kind of makes it more of a factory. And, yeah, they are very militant and protective of their stars, and especially even the convention promoters are, because they're trying to make their money back.
Yeah, and, you know, I can understand that. And, you know, I usually go to just have a good time and meet people. I think this show is pretty small, too, because, you know, maybe they did it on purpose, being the same week as C2E2, but I thought that was a shame because I think it's split.
Absolutely. You
know? So I don't know. I think we may get to an oversaturation point here at some point. I don't know.
I understand, and I think we're heading towards that also. It's really scary that once, you know, March kicks in, there's pretty much medium-sized or big shows happening almost every weekend.
Which is kind of a shock to me, considering the economy and stuff. But, you know, everybody wants to promote their stuff, so.
Sure. Are you going to be able to get out, you know, out from just the California area and do some other shows in other states and other regions?
Yeah, I'd really like to do New York sometime.
Cool.
And maybe even C2E2, you know.
That'd be great.
So far, just kind of pick the ones. Actually, the other one I really want to check out is Emerald City.
I hear nothing but great things about that show. I've yet to go to it, but everyone I know who's gone to it, and certainly the creators really love it, too. It seems like Baltimore, WonderCon in San Francisco, and Emerald City and Heroes are like the four shows that I think creators and fans say they're the most low-key, fun, but still great shows, and that's why they get great guests and everything, and everybody seems to have a great time.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll have to try that out.
Very cool. Well, let's talk about what are you exhibiting at San Diego? What's going to be available there when they come to your table?
Great. Yeah. Basically, I have two volumes that collect the webcomic that's been coming out over the past few years. And then I have two issues of Super Siblings, which feature the antics of Banshee and Scout. And then I have a lot of T-shirts and other geek memorabilia type stuff that I show off at my show, my booth. So, kind of a variety of things, some original art. It's a great opportunity to get a personalized copy of one of the books or get a sketch or something.
I was going to ask, do you do sketches at the show, too?
I'll do, like, little freebie sketches and sketchbooks. But to tell you the truth, I get a little, I don't know, a little chicken to draw a bunch in front of everybody else while they're watching.
Okay. No, I understand. Well, and also, man, I would imagine cranking out the weekly strip and stuff too. You know, you got to save the carpal tunnel for the strip.
Yeah, and you know, I like having a good time. So, you know, if I have my nose in my sketchbook all the time, I feel like I miss something. You know, so I'd take things home and send out commissions, but I don't like to do a lot at the show.
Okay. Well, it's you're going to have then copies of Meet the Clarks and mm-hmm. Super Siblings available, and as you say, T-shirts. Now, you're in the small press area?
Yes.
And what's your table number?
It's P2, and it's basically the front row of the small press area. And we end up facing the DC booth, I think.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. And speaking of DC, Art and Franco are fans of Super Siblings and Meet the Clarks?
Yes. You know, over the years, I've made good friends with them, and I really enjoy, I've had my table next to theirs. I think this year we're actually on different sides, but I've had a great time, and you know, I just kind of admire those guys a lot. I love their kid-friendly material and just their whole attitude, you know. They're a lot of fun.
Well, and I think Super Siblings lines up pretty nicely with what they do in the Billy Batson book and in Tiny Titans, and another good friend of mine, Tom Zoller, who does Love and Capes, I think. You know, there's.
Oh, okay.
I would put your stuff in good company with these kind of products, and it's fun superhero adventure, and it's certainly lighthearted, and I think it's good all ages entertainment, and it also has, especially in Meet the Clarks, obviously that great kind of family dynamic, but a family dynamic that I think fans of geek culture will certainly appreciate the jokes. And it's our kind of humor and our kind of setting. So it's
a code language.
Yeah, if you know, High and Lois were a little funnier and a little hipper, basically. let's put it that way. And I'm only using High and Lois as a base, and I'm sure I'm shitting on some, like, you know, treasured comic strip of some High and Lois fan. But sorry, Jeffy, you don't cut it for me. It's that simple. So
yeah, well, thanks for saying that. I really appreciate that.
Absolutely, man. So it's we'll check you out at San Diego, and it's Super Siblings and Meet the Clarks. You can see it online at supersiblingscomics.com. You're going to love it. You'll see the daily strips there, and there's great ads for all of Patrick's merchandise as well. So check it out. It's supersiblingscomic.com, and it's Super Siblings and Meet the Clark, all done by Patrick Scullin. So thank you very much, Patrick, and good luck at the show, and we'll stop by and say hello to you.
Thank you. Great to meet you, John.
That's Patrick Scullin. Check out the Super Siblings table, P2, in the Small Press Pavilion of San Diego Comic-Con. And I hope to check in with Patrick and see how he's doing. But also, make sure you check out Super Siblings and Meet the Clarks online at supersiblingscomics.com. Also, Alan Heinberg, a big part of today's show. Make sure you check out Avengers the Crusade, which begins Thursday. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress here, and reminding you to check us out online. We're at iTunes and at iFanboy.com. Of course, WordBalloon.com. You'll find our archive of well over 300 interviews with comic book creators, film people, television people, all talking about our favorite pop culture subjects. Today's Word Balloon was brought to you by Super Siblings, the all-ages comic for geeks and their kids, created by Patrick Scullin, following the adventures of a brother and sister with superpowers, Conrad, a.k.a. Scout, and Courtney, a.k.a. Banshee. Read Super Siblings, the webcomic, every week at supersiblingscomics.com, and make sure you come by and pick up a signed copy of Super Siblings issues 1 or 2 at this year's San Diego Comic-Con. Patrick has a table in the Small Press Pavilion. That's P2. Word Balloon has an iPhone and iPad app available at the iTunes Store. If you're interested, it's $2.99, and it's a great way to follow Word Balloon. Thanks again for the people that have already bought the app, and if you're interested, it's waiting for you there at the iTunes Store. Follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon, or, of course, at Facebook under my name, John Suntress. Or you can leave me an email at wordballoon.com. John@wordballoon.com is the way to get me. Or you can just leave a comment on this week's show posted at wordballoon.com. Thanks again for listening. More coverage on the road to San Diego continues in the days and weeks ahead. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.